for today. Thank you. The first of which is that this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The Clumin training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. You can use the Q&A pod at the bottom of your screen to make any comments, ask questions, or report any technical problems that you have during today's training. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of today's modules. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available at the end of the training by completing the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. The feedback form can also be found on the Clumin training page that brought you here today. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Cluin. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome you to today's training, An Introduction to PFAS, which is based on ITRC's PFAS team's online resources. My name is Devin Setkar, and I'm going to be your moderator today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, the federal government, academia, the private sector, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website where you can find our current teams and learn about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy and make sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. On slide four, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of our expert trainers have served on the PFAS team over the years and not only volunteered to develop those resources, but also to develop this training offer today. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to our first trainer, Christy Herzer from the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation to get us started.
Thank you, Devin. So just as an overview of what we're going to be going over today, I'll start you off with an introduction to ITRC and our PFAS team. We'll move into naming conventions and sources, followed by aqueous film-forming foams. We'll go over fate and transport and site characterization, and then we'll take a 10-minute question and answer break. Then we'll come back with sampling and analysis and end with treatment technologies, and we will have questions at the end as well. So as Devin said, the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council is a 501c3 program of the Environmental Council of the States, or ECOS. We are comprised of over 1,000 members, including state, federal, stakeholder, tribal, academic, and industry members. We do have a quick poll that's going to open up on your screen, and we'd love for you to fill it out. So which of the following best characterizes your experience with PFAS at environmental sites, starting with none at all, very little, so less than a year, or just a couple of sites, 2 to 5 years, or 10 to 20 sites, or over 5 years and 20 or more sites. So go ahead and please take a moment and pick which best describes your experience. All right, so it looks like a majority of folks starting off with none or less than a year or a couple sites. That's excellent because, as a reminder, this is a training that's intended for folks who are relatively new to the world of PFAS. So that's excellent. So the ITRC PFAS team is comprised of just over 500 professionals across all sectors who come together to share their expertise and interest to develop readily accessible technical resources. And our team strives to provide a balanced overview of the current state of knowledge about PFAS in order to support decision making associated with the management of PFAS contamination. We encourage you to take a look at our consensus-driven free technical resources, which can all be found on our website. You can find our technical and regulatory guidance document, or you'll hear us call it the tech reg for short. This is in the process of being updated. The newest version will be posted later in September. We also have 13 fact sheets, which will also be updated to remain current with the tech reg. We have video modules posted online, and also we conduct outreach such as today's training. And just a note, today's training does reference some of that new material that's going to be published later in September, so y'all will be getting a sneak peek. We also have a number of external tables and information you can download and access quickly, such as our soil and regulatory guidance values table, which is updated approximately quarterly, and these are all really excellent resources. I mentioned our 13 fact sheets, and here's the full list. All of our fact sheets go through the same rigorous review process as our tech reg. And again, they'll be updated to reflect the current information in the tech reg that'll be posted later in September. Now I'm going to pass it over to my colleague, Mitch Olson, to talk to you about PFAS naming conventions and sources.
Very good. Thank you, Christy. Yep, this is Mitch Olson from Tri-Hydro, and I will be speaking to the first two sections here today, starting off with PFAS naming conventions and sources, and then the and I'll talk a bit about AFFF as well. So we'll get into that here momentarily. What we're looking at here, this is an outline of the guidance document, sections that pertain to the section that I'll be talking about here up front. And general, the presentation outline that I'll be following is in line with this outline as we're looking at here right now. Pointing out here section 2.2 in particular, chemistry terminology and acronyms. To manage all of your expectations, there's quite a fair bit of chemistry and acronyms in this world. So we'll try our best to make this process of introducing some of these concepts as painless as possible. We'll probably spend the bulk of the time in this first section going through some of that, enough detail to help to understand what's going to be coming up later on in the presentation. But then we'll talk more about uses and products and the different areas there. Starting off with PFAS definitions and nomenclature. So as noted here, there is not a single universally accepted definition of PFAS. There's the list of references shown below here. There's more references than this. Each of these has some take on a definition of PFAS, and honestly, they're rather complicated. But the defining theme of PFAS is that they're carbon atoms that are linked to each other, bonded to fluorine atoms. It's that carbon-fluorine bond that's really the distinguishing feature of PFAS compounds. We're looking at a molecular image here of one compound on the right. This is PFOA, and we'll look at this in more detail. The chemistry of PFAS is part of what makes them very interesting, what's made them very useful, but part of what needs to be understood in terms of what makes them so unique in terms of how we have to manage PFAS. So starting into key terms and acronyms, PFAS is an acronym for this term, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. That's a blanket term. There's thousands of compounds that are part of this the PFAS compound family. There's a relatively small list of these that we pay most of our attention to. And we'll try to break this apart a little bit and provide a little background on the compounds that we're going to be focusing mostly on. So this acronym stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. The difference between these two groups, perfluoroalkyl substances, that term per means that the carbon is saturated with fluorine, whereas poly is not saturated. It means multiple. There's multiple carbon-fluorine bonds, but there's also carbon that is not bonded to fluorine, which is the difference between those two groups. And we'll get into that in a little bit more detail. Within the perfluoroalkyl substance group, there's subgroups that we're going to be talking about quite a bit. So I do want to kind of pause here and make sure that we're clear on these different acronyms that we're going to be using as we go further into this presentation. This term perfluoroalkyl acids is a subgroup within the perfluoroalkyl substance family. And then within that, perfluoroalkyl carboxylates, PFCAs, perfluoroalkane sulfonates, PFSAs, are two different groups. And we're going to be referring to these quite a bit. So just want to make sure that we're going to be clear in these acronyms, the difference between PFAS, PFAAs, perfluorocarboxylates, PFCAs, PFSAs. Perfluorocarboxylic acids, one of the most well-known compounds within that group is perfluorooctanoic acid, PFOA, which is shown here in the upper right. Within the perfluoroalkane sulfonates, the PFSAs, perfluorooctane sulfonate, or PFOS, is shown there. So common features of these compounds, both of them have this the carbon chain bonded to fluorine, and it's this carbon-fluorine chain that gives PFAS a lot of their unique features, the high stability. It's a very difficult bond to break, strongest bond in organic chemistry. It's also repellent to both water and to oil. It's hydrophobic, lipophobic. Another one of the properties that makes PFAS so very useful, that's why they're very widely used, but adds to the challenge in terms of how PFAS are managed. Difference between PFOA and PFOS, if you look at the right-hand side of these chemicals as we're looking at them, both of them on the left-hand side have this carbon-fluorine tail. The functional group is different. The carboxylic acid group on the PFCAs versus the sulfonic acid group and the PFSAs. And so we'll look into this a little bit more deeply in terms of the these different families, PFCAs, PFSAs, and also talk a little bit more about the polyfluoroalkyl substances too. There's one example shown here, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. So I want to replant these acronyms in your head one more time. PFAS is the big blanket term. PFAAs is that subgroup within perfluoroalkyls, and PFCAs, PFSAs are both within that PFAA family. So now we're going to spend a few slides talking more about these perfluoroalkyl acids. The PFAAs are primarily what we're concerned with in a lot of the data that we would be collecting and would be looking closely at. The common features of the perfluoroalkyl acids, again, the fully fluorinated chain, two or more carbon tails. We put the tail of these compounds is that carbon fluorine chain. And as noted previously, this carbon-fluorine bond is very strong. The tail is both lipid and water-repelling. And then the other end of the compound is this head, this functional group. Again, for PFCAs, it's a carboxylic acid group. PFSAs, sulfonate group. So these are the basic structures of the PFAAs. They can vary in terms of chain length. We'll talk about that here as well here in a moment. And now looking at the naming system, the two compounds that we've been looking at here, PFOA, PFOS, follow this convention in terms of how these perfluoroalkyl acids are named. They all start with PF, short for perfluoro. The next letter in this acronym is an indicative of the number of carbons within the group. And this is following organic chemistry nomenclature, alkyl chemistry compounds are named according to this window that's shown in here for buta, 5-penta, and so forth. And then the letter that's used to substitute for that to indicate that is indicated here as well. So that third letter indicates the number of carbons, and then the last letter indicates functional group, either S for the sulfonates or A for the carboxylates. And then how this looks in terms of the entire family of these compounds, the different chain lengths are illustrated on this table here. So for at the top of the table, we see a four carbon chain group. PFBA is perfluorobutanoic acid, perfluorobutanoate, and PFBS is perfluorobutane sulfonoic acid, and so forth. I have a box drawn around here around the compounds that we're most familiar with, the PFOA and the PFOS. So as we move down this table, the difference in each of these compounds is the carbon chain length. And then there's analogous compounds that are both part of the PFCA group and part of the PFSA group. And so this is where the names and the acronyms that we come across are built from. Another key feature of the PFAAs that we wanted to shine a spotlight on here is the chain length. The chain length refers to the length of this carbon-fluorine chain, the tail of each of these compounds. This is a table from our guidance document. The upper group of compounds is the PFCAs. The lower group here is the PFSAs. These acronyms going across then from the table that we were just looking at. So short chain on the left to longer chain on the right. And there's a dividing line that's been established in terms of what we consider to be a long chain versus a short chain PFAS. For the PFCAs, that dividing line is eight carbons or more are considered long chain PFAS. For the PFSAs, six carbons or more. An example of a short chain and a long chain is shown here at the bottom, where perfluorobutane carboxylate, or PFBA, the shortest compound shown on here, that four carbon chain, versus the long chain PFOA. So I do want to make sure that that part is clear as well, because we do refer regularly here to long chain versus short chain PFAAs as we go through this. They have different properties in terms of how they move and bioaccumulation and so forth. So I want to make sure that that part is clear as well. And then speaking of the long chain PFAS, wanted to make a mention here about the phase out of long chain PFAS. Historically, conventionally, some of the earlier PFAS mixtures that were produced were primarily long chain PFAS, but they've also gained additional attention in terms of potential for bioaccumulation and other environmental impacts. And as that became apparent, the long chain PFAS have become phased out to some extent. And some notes here about what that phase out has looked like. Really beginning in the early 2000s, where 3M, one of the manufacturers, began phasing out production of PFOS, PFHXS, the six carbon chain version of the PFOS compound, and similar precursors. And so that addresses the PFSAs. As far as the PFCAs, beginning in the middle 2010s and so forth, most manufacturers have eliminated production of PFOA. So manufacturing has moved towards the shorter chain PFAS compounds, at least in the United States and Eastern Europe. Although noted here, long chain production has continued on a worldwide scale, but shifted to different parts of the world. Next slide. I'm sorry. Another change that's made over time is in terms of replacement chemistry. Some of the earlier widely produced PFAS compounds have been replaced by other compounds. We mentioned in the previous slide a transition from focus more on the longer chain PFAS compounds to shorter chain PFAS compounds. And some advantages of that, primarily the short chain PFAS compounds do not transform into the long chain PFAAs. Now, in addition to the transition from long chain to short chain PFAAs, some other replacement chemicals have also been produced. And two of the most widely known, widely produced versions are shown here. HFPODA, which is a component of a compound referred to as GenX, which has been used for decades in fluoropolymer production. ADONA is another that's considered a replacement compound. And as we can see here, looking at the chemical structures, they're similar overall when we compare them to the PFAAs that we've been looking at. But an oxygen's been thrown into that carbon. They're called ether compounds. So similar properties in a lot of ways, but a slightly different structure so that it's not the same compound effectively. Because these are relatively new for the most part, for most of these replacement chemistries, information is relatively limited to this point compared to the long chain compounds that were more historically produced and understood. So, information is more limited in terms of toxicities, properties, fate, and transport, and other factors. One final item related to PFAAs that we want to talk about, and this is an area that has caused quite a bit of confusion, for good reason, I think. For those who don't think about chemistry very often, this is not very straightforward. But the compounds that we're talking about here, those PFAAs, are all acids. And thinking back to general chemistry, general acid-base chemistry, all this applies to these compounds. They can be present in multiple forms, either in the environment or in the form that they're initially used in. And so I think we wanted to talk about this a little bit more and provide some understanding as far as what the difference is. They can be present. What is effectively the same compound can be present in either an acid, a salt, or an anion form. It's the same compound because everything is the same except for this end group. And the different versions are shown here. This is kind of looking at the right-hand side, the functional group head on PFOS. When present in the acid form, you can see that there's a hydrogen attached to this oxygen. In the salt form, it might be sodium or potassium. It's the salt form that might be provided in as a solid form. And then there's the anion form, where either if it starts off as the acid or the salt, the hydrogen or the sodium or the potassium dissociates into water. It's the anion form that we would almost entirely come across in the environment when they're dissolved into water. Unless the pH is extremely low, the acid would dissociate and form the anion, and the salt as well would dissociate. So it's the anion form that we primarily expect to encounter in the environment. However, laboratories sometimes will report concentrations using the acid form of the compound, and often the names are used interchangeably. Some confusion can result too because different CASP numbers are assigned to the compounds based on different forms. So I think having some understanding of the different forms can be in, but that the fact that they refer to similar compounds is important to understand. So the PFAAs that we've been talking about these last few slides, again, those perfluoroalkyl acids, those are all perfluoroalkyl substances. And I wanted to circle back here and now talk briefly about the polyfluoroalkyl substance, the other side of that PFAS acronym. So again, these polyfluoroalkyl substances are not fully fluorinated. They're partially fluorinated. There is a portion of the compound that does not have that carbon-fluorine bond. An interesting feature of the polyfluoroalkyl substances, they're sometimes referred to as precursors. And part of the reason for that is that they can break down, they can partially break down, they can transform, but they won't completely break down. A PFAS will remain a PFAS. That carbon fluorine tail of these compounds is generally not going to be considered to be degradable under normal conditions, but the that right-hand side functional group in a polyfluoroalkyl substance can. An interesting side note on that is that that is part of the reason that in, say, a wastewater treatment plant, we might see concentration of PFOA, for instance, increase in the effluent relative to the influent. Presence of these precursors that may partially break down form a perfluoroalkyl acid such as PFOA as an end product, but that will not break down any further. One example of one of the more commonly encountered types of polyfluoroalkyl substances is shown here, 8,2-fluorotelomer alcohol. A lot of the polyfluoroalkyl substances are these fluorotelomer groups. The naming convention used here, that 8,2 refers to the length of the fluorinated carbon chain and then the non-fluorinated chain. That's where the 8,2 comes from. This is a relatively simple and non-polar, non-anionic version of a polyfluoroalkyl substance. Part of the reason that there can be thousands of compounds within this PFAS family, though, is that this that head of the compound can become extremely complex in terms of the shape that it takes, even different ionic forms. What we're showing here is a neutral form with the fluorotelomer alcohol. They can be anions, they can be cations, even Zwitter ions, which is a concept that I don't want to talk too much about. But a Zwitter ion has both a positive and negative charge simultaneously on the same compound. So things can get pretty complicated here. But that does have significant implications in terms of how PFAS fate and transport occurs within the environment. And we'll talk more about that as we move through this. So just putting this together in terms of the PFAS family tree, and I'll just talk briefly about this. Don't want to go through this in too much detail here at this point. But PFAS as a whole can be broken down into both polymer and non-polymer forms. Polymers are what's used in a lot of common products, and typically not what we're most concerned about in terms of environmental transport for PFAS. But polymers can eventually break down potentially and form these non-polymer compounds. And it's within the non-polymers that we are talking about these perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances. So again, the PFAAs that we're talking about, and then the subgroups, PFCAs, PFSAs, that are part of that PAA family are part of that perfluoroalkyl substance group. All right, so that wraps up the chemistry acronym definition part. And I'll talk a little bit more now about PFAS uses and how they're released into the environment before moving into the AFFF section. So this timeline provides a brief overview of PFAS, how they've been produced and used historically. Originally developed in the 1930s, 1940s, in fact, had a role in the Manhattan Project. The commercial production of PFAS originated really in the 1950s, took off to a different level in the 1960s. Particularly worth calling out in the 1960s, that is the time that US military adopted PFAS-containing firefighting foams as their standard, as their specified product to, for putting out Class B flammable liquid type fires, and it became industry standard, and that really ramped up the use of PFAS containing firefighting foams. So the 1950s through the present day is really when commercial production has occurred. Some health concerns started to become apparent in the early 1970s, but it was really in the late 90s and into the 2000s that they started to really become well known. And that's what has led to some of these phase outs and reductions and producing of alternatives. As I mentioned a few slides ago, the transition to some of the shorter chain compounds and wider use of the replacement chemistry type compounds, and also improvements in analytical detection and analytical methods. Another note I wanted to call out in terms of historical production, just briefly here, but this is a concept we're going to circle back here to later on in the presentation. There are two really major production processes that have been used: electrochemical fluorination, or ECF, and then telomerization. The ECF process was the more widely used historically, some of the earlier production of ECF, and that tapered off really in the 1990s. Fluorotelomerization began to be used in the 70s and became more of the primary production method beginning really in the early 2000s. There's different signatures in the compounds that are produced through these two methods, and I think that's what the important thing to call out here is that PFAS produced using either of these methods leaves this mark behind. And as we get into site characterization and more advanced analytical methods, we'll talk about this more in terms of how the implications of this and how that can be interpreted. In terms of primary PFAS uses and sources into the environment, in short, there's a lot of them. PFAS have been really very widely used across society, both in terms of commercial consumer products and industrial uses. And so, highlights of a few of the primary uses and then subsequent how they're become sources into the environment. One of the really most widespread uses here is as aqueous film-forming foam, or AFFF. These are the firefighting foams used to put out Class B flammable liquid type fires. The reason PFAS containing foams are so widely used is that they're extremely effective. If you ever watch a video of a flame getting put out using these PFAS containing foams, they work almost miraculously. But because of this widespread use since really beginning in the 1960s, their presence is noted at military installations, civil airports, as well as oil and gas facilities. A lot of firefighting departments where there's training or an actual incident response areas. Also widely used in industry, both in terms of primary manufacturing where the PFAS are produced, but then also secondary industrial uses, industries that use PFAS. There's quite a few of these industries, ranging from plastics to chrome plating and textiles, leather, paper, quite a few of these industries. The two sources on the right-hand side are a little bit different in that they don't generally use PFAS directly, but these are concentration points. These are areas where PFAS that have been used in other sources can end up and ultimately become a source then into the environment. So this is the case for both landfills, wastewater treatment plants, sources of PFAS into landfills, because PFAS are so widely used in consumer products that have ultimately been disposed of at landfills. Concentrations can vary significantly in water associated with landfills, depending on the type of waste it's received. Certain landfills receiving waste from industries associated with PFAS can have much higher concentrations. That also applies to the wastewater treatment plants. Wastewater from any source, municipal or commercial, can have some level of PFAS in it. Concentrations can vary significantly, however, based on the type of source and where that water's coming from. Potential effluent from wastewater treatment plants may include the direct liquid discharge, also biosolids. This chart illustrates at a conceptual level the primary links between sources and exposure. We'll discuss the specific pathways more in subsequent sections, but just want to speak to this here at a high level. The primary different uses of PFAS, where PFAS may origin as a source into the environment, include production, primary production, use in manufacturing, use in industrial products, and potential exposures that come from that may include both direct occupational exposure or release into the environment. There's also PFAS that may be present in consumer products, which can lead to non-occupational human exposures. Following from environmental occurrence, then we can see that can lead to both ecological exposures or human non-occupational exposures. And there's also the link coming back from ecological to human non-occupational. And we'll speak to these in more detail, particularly in the fate and transport section, which will be coming up shortly. And I'm wrapping up this section with a few comments about PFAS and some recent claims about PFAS use and occurrence. PFAS in a lot of products have been well documented, particularly in stain-resistant materials, waterproof. There's a few that are gaining some emerging attention, and we wanted to speak briefly to some of those here. One of which is food packaging. There's been a few studies that have been picked up by media sources in recent years. The PFAS are associated with food packaging because they may be added to a paper to prevent prevent grease from soaking through and creating other problems. So it's been a fairly well understood and widespread use of PFAS. Also mentioning one that's gotten some attention is fluorinated HDPE containers. This started getting attention originating from some pesticides that were found to be creating PFAS impacts. And then tracing back the source of the PFAS in those pesticides, it was found to come from containers that the pesticides were transferred in. Fluorinated HDPE is produced to create a more stable container, something that's not going to react with or degrade the product that's inside of the container. Some subsequent studies have shown that the fluorine added to the HDPE containers under certain circumstances may lead to formation of PFAS that can leach into the products that they're forming. Also, some attention's been shown on for synthetic turf. There's some articles that have linked PFAS presence to synthetic turf. At this point, some subsequent research has indicated no scientific evidence directly linked PFAS to the artificial turf itself. One particular case in Connecticut was getting some attention in that area. So more research being done in that area. Also, cosmetics and personal care products is an ongoing area of research in terms of where PFAS may be used. One particular area that's gotten some attention is PFOA associated with sunscreen in a particular study. Finally, some notes about PFAS certification and projects. This is a relatively emerging area, but there are numerous labels and certifications that are available now for in terms of PFAS and consumer products. There's not a single standardized universal method in terms of how this labeling occurs at this point. Commonly used labels include PFAS-free, PFOS, PFOA-free, fluorine-free. Some of these can be applied relatively loosely at this point in time. To help provide some guidance in terms of where things currently stand, there's a table that I won't go through in detail here, but that's included as part of the guidance document. That's a good resource for more information. A lot of these certifications also worth noting here. So the certifications may allow some minimum level. It may not necessarily mean there's absolutely no PFAS, because if you analyze it a low enough level, you might find it in a lot of places. So there's going to be some threshold level. So very good. That ends the introductory section on PFAS naming and use. Now we'll talk about AFFF. So as noted on the previous slide, one of the primary uses of PFAS and one of the most widespread sources of PFAS in the environment is this use as firefighting foam. Since the Department of Defense picked up standardized use of AFFF, of PFAS-containing AFFF in the mid-1960s, and it's become standard practice. And to this day, firefighting foams may contain PFAS, but a transition is underway. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through these slides. So again, here we'll start off with a reference to the guidance document. For if you're looking for more information on PFAS firefighting foams, look at section 3, which focuses on AFFF. There's also a couple of external tables that provide some useful information, particularly the AFFF characteristics. And I'll refer to that a bit as we go through this. Useful table because the composition of these AFFFs have changed over time with different manufacturers. So being able to have a resource to understand what the source of a particular AFFF is will be helpful in terms of interpreting data that may be generated at a particular site. Okay, so speaking now to the Starting off, the higher level look at the different classes of firefighting foams. There are a couple of different classes of foams: Class A foams, Class B foams. The Class A foams, to be clear here, the Class A foams do not contain PFAS. These were developed in the 1980s for other uses, fighting wildfires, structure fires, not flammable liquid fires, and they do not contain PFAS. It's the Class B foams that we are concerned with here, and these are particularly designed. And they're specifically designed for the purpose of fighting flammable liquid type fires that require special a special type of foam in order to achieve effective treatment. There are fluorine-free and fluorinated foams available. This is part of the big transition that is probably in the early stages, but is underway towards use of fluorine-free foams. They've been on the market for a while. So as implied by the name, fluorine-free foams do not contain PFAS. A couple of different types of foams are shown here on the table here, but we're going to focus mostly here on the fluorinated foams for our discussion now. Primarily on these, the upper square here on the left, aqueous film-forming foams, or AFFFs, which have different subcategories based on when they were manufactured and who the manufacturer was. And that's where we will really be focusing on here, is the those types of foams. So the particular subcategories for AFFF include the legacy PFOS AFFF, which was the early generation of this foam, manufactured for the 1960s until 2002, manufactured exclusively by one manufacturer. This was by 3M and sold under the name of Lightwater, with sub-licensing that was done to other companies as well. Legacy PFAS AFFF contains PFOS and the PFSAs. So remembering back to those acronyms you're talking about, PFSAs, PFOS is one compound from that family of category, and then all the different chain length compounds, kind of the PFOS sister compounds, are the primary constituents of this foam. Although this was phased out in 2002 because of legacy use, going back to the 1960s, this was one of the widespread used products and is the source of a lot of AFFF that has caused impacts in the environment that we're now managing. The next down here is the legacy fluorotelomer AFFF, which was produced. So, as I mentioned previously, the fluorotelomer process was the more recently developed production process. So, these were really produced and used in the United States beginning in the 1970s through 2016-ish, and really encompass other brands aside from the 3M Lightwater. That is the legacy PFOS that we referred to. And we'll talk a little bit more about the specific composition difference between those two types of foams. Now, the modern fluorotelomer AFFF is sometimes referred to as a C6 foam. The legacy foams, both the legacy PFOS and the legacy fluorotelomer, are often referred to as C8 foams. And that refers back to that long chain to short chain transition, and C8 being a dividing line, particularly for the PFSAs between the long and short chain. So the legacy foam are often referred to as C8, whereas the modern fluorotelomer foams referred to as C6, another term that we'll be referring to a little bit as we go through this. So looking a little bit closer at these different types of foams, again, we have these three primary types of AFFF: the legacy PFAS AFFF, the legacy fluorotelomer AFFFs, and then the modern fluorotelomer AFFFs. The legacy PFAS AFFF, again, manufactured by a single manufacturer using a process, the ECF process, which produces a unique signature in terms of the composition. A wide range, relatively complex chemistry of what's produced, a wide range of chain lengths, both branched and linear isomers, which do produce a unique fingerprint that can become apparent in the analysis and be useful in terms of subsequent fate and transport evaluation, source identification, and such. An illustration here in the bottom right shows how this looks in terms of the chromatogram produced through analyzing for these compounds. The legacy fluorotelomer AFFFs contain polyfluorinated PFAS, which can transform into PFCAs. Again, relatively small amount of direct PFCAs, but it's the polyfluorinated precursors that this may contain. The fluoroelastomer AFFFs contain no PFOS. PFOS is exclusively linked with the legacy PFOS AFFF. And it also does not contain precursors that would transform into PFOS. And then by comparison, the modern fluoroelastomer AFFFs, so these have become widespread relatively recently, really since 2000 and more so in the 2010s, latter 2010s, developed in response to the PFOA, PFOS phase out. Now, again, this is referred to as sometimes referred to as C6 foams because they're the process is redesigned to focus on production of the short chain, those C6 or shorter types of compounds, which, as mentioned previously, cannot degrade and form the longer chain PFAS compounds. Not to say that there's no PFOA or compounds that could degrade into PFOA, but there are trace amounts, relatively small amounts compared to what would be expected in a legacy AFFF. Now, looking at the composition of an AFFF, when you buy an AFFF off the shelf, it might come in a 5 gallon bucket or larger size container, but the it's provided as a concentrate. And so we look at what the composition of this concentrate is. AFFF isn't just PFAS. It contains mostly up to 60% water and diluent. 20% of the composition is solvents. As much as 18% are surfactants, and the fluorosurfactants are a relatively small fraction of these surfactants, less than 2%. Most of the surfactants are hydrocarbon types of surfactants. So this is the composition of what's referred to as a 3% AFFF concentrate. These AFFF concentrates are sold in a 1% or 3%, 6% are the typical concentrations they're provided in. Worth pointing out, it's somewhat counterintuitive, I think, in that a 6% AFFF concentrate is actually less concentrated than a 1%. That percent refers to the amount of water that it needs to be mixed with in order to get the target amount for actual fighting of fires. So a 1% AFFF needs to be mixed, is a higher concentration that we need to be mixed with more water than a 6% in order to get to that target concentration level. Now, this shows some summary data from the table. I mentioned the table at the beginning here that summarizes some composition information in a lot of different AFFF products, and just provide these pie charts show a summary of how compositions look different in the different AFFF products produced at different times and through different manufacturers. The one on the left-hand side is one of the legacy PFAS AFFFs, and we can see it's primarily 94% perfluorosulfonic acids, which is the PFOS and its related sister compounds, and relatively small amounts. The PFCAs are present, but a relatively small amount, 4% is indicated here. A more recently produced version of the 3M AFFF. Would still contain primarily the PFS, the perfluorosulfonic acids, but the composition has changed a bit over time there as well. But then we see a drastic difference when we look at a modern AFFF by a different manufacturer. A lot more of the precursors are present in this compound. So we see the acronyms that are the 8,2-FT, the 8,2-fluorotelomer that we had looked at previously, but rather than the OH alcohol end group, we see more complicated functional groups there at the end, which can then partially break down and form some of these compounds that we might be more familiar with looking for. All right. So now moving ahead into how AFFF is applied and used in the environment. The foam is applied by mixing the AFFF concentrate with water. It's aerated at the nozzle and deployed out on the ground. Then what happens? The foam is very effective at putting fires out. Generally, it does quickly, but once the fire is extinguished, the foam remains. Current best practice is generally to contain that foam and treat it, but historically that hasn't always been the case. The foam may be left to dissipate as it sees fit, and this might involve surface runoff. Often, if foam is discharged on a concrete area, it might be conveyed through a stormwater system. If it's on a dirt area, most of the foam may infiltrate into shallow soils where it could eventually then leach down into groundwater. The different methods, different mechanisms through which foam with HFRF may be released into the environment are summarized here. There's some accidental methods might involve low volume releases of concentrate through spills or through leaks. Deliberate methods, which would generally involve larger volumes but lower concentrations because of the foam being mixed with water before being deployed, might involve moderate volume discharges of foam solution doing through standard firefighting operations, both through firefighting or vapor suppression if a leak has occurred from a hydrocarbon tank, for instance, or in infrequent high volume broadcast discharge where there's a large scale fire event, and then training applications. These periodic moderate to high volume broadcast discharge areas are areas where high concentrations may be accumulated in shallow soils due to the repeated applications. There's also potential for accidental events that could occur in cases where, for instance, at a hangar in an airport, a case I've heard of is where a painter accidentally triggered a deluge event, and then the foam is discharged, couldn't be turned off, and that ultimately has to be led to dissipate. Data collection and modeling for AFFF fate and transport is really the next item to consider when we're starting to think about sites where AFFF has been discharged and then what's become of this. The data collection associated with AFFF and fate and transport, and I'll focus on the AFFF aspect here. Really, the after release of AFFF, the subsequent section here will talk. Sandra is going to talk a lot more in detail about PFAS-specific fate and transport in the environment. So the data collection and modeling associated with AFFF fate and transport can be used to address environmental risk, development of a conceptual site model, which shown here is a generic look at what a conceptual site model may look like in terms of all the processes through which AFFF may be dispersed through the environment after release. A few different properties of PFAS that affect fate and transport here are summarized here, and I won't go into these in detail because, again, that'll be covered in detail in the next section. But PFAS have very unique physical and chemical properties that affect how they move through the environment. The concept of the precursor transformation is another important concept. Several processes, both abiotic and biological, can lead to a transformation of precursors into the PFCAs and PFSAs. And primary mechanisms that we're concerned about with AFFF, vapor transport can be a concern. They can be, although not very volatile, some of the PFAS compounds are volatile. They can also transport through the air as mists, or if wind is blowing as foam is deployed, there's atmospheric mechanisms. But the primary dispersion mechanisms that we are mostly concerned about include surface water discharge, where the foam may eventually settle out and be conveyed through a stormwater system or infiltration into shallow soils. All right, for the next couple of slides, wrapping up the AFFF section, we'll be talking about best management practices for AFFF. As we're moving into a point in time where fluorine-free foams are becoming much more available and likely to become more standardized here in the very near future. It's going to change the approach in terms of how AFFF should be managed. A lot of sites, because of the long shelf life, many sites may contain legacy forms of the AFFF or the C8 types of foams. So when we're thinking about a transition, this could be considered in terms of a transition from a C8 to a C6 type foam, or transition from either a C8 or a C6 into a fluorine-free type of a foam. All of these are types of transitions that might be considered at this point. So when we're thinking of management of AFFF, this image on the right-hand side kind of illustrates how we may look at this, that the PFAS in a foam has some potential harm and is therefore considered a hazard. In order for that hazard to turn into a risk, there must be some form of exposure. So keeping tabs, making sure that good best management practices are being used reduces the risk of the exposure element. And then in time, as a transition away from PFAS-containing foams occurs, that will reduce the hazard element of this as well. So all of this is intended to, in the long run, reduce the risk associated with exposure to PFAS. So what it comes down to, it in terms of best management practice for foam that may be on site, whether it be a legacy C8 or a modern C6 type of a foam, knowledge is key. Making sure that there's a good inventory of all the foam that's on site with detailed information in terms of what the manufacturer is, the type of foam, the type of use that it's intended for, how it would be deployed. Understanding the performance specifications that foam is intended to meet is important. Now, also the concentrate of the foam. All of these and then volumes, storage containers, where they are stored, where they have historically been stored. All of these are good information to collect up front and have available. They are it's imperative in terms of reducing the chance that some accidental release occurs, but also when considering a transition, having all this data at your fingertips is going to be a very important part of understanding and designing a system properly when a transition is occurring. In terms of foam storage and handling, several different types of containers that the foam may be stored in, depending on the size of the system and the needs for a particular site. This may not have been a big issue for firefighting foams previously, but it is now. Ensuring secondary containment is in place to avoid spills or mishaps leading to accidental releases of these foams into the environment. In terms of PFAS and disposal, referring here to a EPA document released in December of 2020. This was a EPA, this document was interim guidance on destroying and disposing of certain PFAS containing materials. Now, this was released in December 2020, as noted. An updated version, this was an interim document. Updated version is scheduled to be released in the not too distant future. A good reference in terms of what the state of the science was in 2020. Things have developed a little bit since then. A few highlights from the guidance disposal are discussed here that any fire and flush water containing PFAS should be disposed of as a generated waste. I mean, what this is really saying is that the AFFF should, after it has been deployed, should be collected at this point, knowing what we know now, rather than let foam just disperse into the environment. And AFFF that is being replaced or that has been spent should be contained to the extent possible and then disposed of as a generated waste. PFAS in water can be processed to concentrate PFAS. Especially for in the case where PFAS has been discharged as foam, as where AFFF is discharged as foam, there are technologies available where the PFAS can be concentrated prior to disposal to reduce treatment or transportation costs. As far as options for disposing of that concentrated waste, in accordance with this EPA guidance, primary available approaches include incineration or landfilling, deep well injection. At the time of this document was produced, EPA didn't ultimately sign off on any of those as being a go-to technology. But they did say that waste could be stored until a better opportunity comes along. At the current time, even though the EPA didn't sign off on incineration or landfilling, that is still a go-to option for a lot of these wastes. And in fact, the Department of Defense has recently released a guidance for their waste, which provides a mechanism through which PFAS waste incineration and landfilling might be considered under certain circumstances, limited circumstances, using only permitted facilities that meet certain criteria. So best management practices include accounting for all volumes. That's a key item for this. Circling back to the last slide, the idea that of keeping a tight inventory, making sure that AFFF isn't going to be slipping through the cracks in terms of how it's disposed of. Now, some considerations in terms of foam replacement as well. I mentioned previously that foam replacement might be considered in different, depending on the needs for a particular site. A transition from C8 to a C6 may be fitting if the circumstances dictate that a use of a fluorinated foam is still needed in order to meet performance specifications. Otherwise, a transition from C8 to C6 to fluorine-free might be considered under certain circumstances too. So that really does require a very a detailed evaluation on what needs are present at a particular site. So a lot of the different options or considerations are illustrated here on the this figure on the right-hand side. I think what's most important to point out here is that if considering a fluorine-free foam for replacement, they are not a drop-in replacement. You cannot plan on just purchasing a replacement on just purchasing a replacement fluorine-free foam and expecting it to be able to work with an existing system. You'll need to look closely at the system, at the foam properties. Items shown here on the right-hand side, how the foam is going to be used. Another item to consider is if equipment's going to be replaced or cleaned out, particularly for foam storage tanks or equipments that have come into contact with the old PFAS-containing foam. At this point in time, there is not an established guidance, not a complete guidance for how to decontaminate and confirm that an old PFAS-containing foam is completely replaced before adding. So there are procedures becoming developed, but no established guidance yet at this point. So ultimately, these factors to consider in terms of a fluorine-free foam replacement, what are the current performance requirements? Is a fluorine-free foam going to be able to meet the requirements in terms of being able to get a fire out at a facility as expected and needed when an actual incident occurs? What application techniques are anticipated? And also, how clean does the system need to be? Again, the procedure for cleaning out a system is still being established. So final note here in terms of the fluorine-free foam and the state of the science for research and development, there are several projects that have been funded by the Department of Defense through their CERDP and ESTCP research programs. And these research programs have contributed in part to recent specifications that the Department of Defense released in January of this year regarding fluorine-free foams. So now that the Department of Defense has finally released a specification for fluorine-free foam, and we're expecting to see more products become certified under this new specification here in the not-too-distant future, and that's going to really lead to fuel a transition, a greater scale transition towards the fluorine-free foams. That'll impact airports somewhat directly, and then provide more options for industry to consider this transition as well. All right, so that wraps up the AFFF section. I'll turn this over to Sandra for Fate and Transport.
That was amazing. So much great information. Thank you so much, Mitch. I will discuss the fate and transport and take us into the question and answer period after the top of the hour. So, hello, everyone. I'm Sandra Goodrow. I'm a research scientist for New Jersey DEP, and I will be covering the essentials of fate and transport. And I will provide some of the related considerations when evaluating a contaminated site. We're going to keep this fairly high level, but as you know, there's an amazing ITRC PFAS guidance document that really provides a deeper dive into any of the specifics that you want to know more about. So let me give you a general idea of where to find the related information in the guidance document. So the final web document that has been mentioned before is at the PFAS/1 website. It will be updated in September, but that's the entire document. That's the homepage. You're going to find the guidance document there. So the online guidance document, you'll be able to navigate through the sections, but you'll also find the fact sheets, the training videos, some external tables that Christy mentioned earlier. So there's a lot there. The sections that you'll want to look at that relate specifically to the fate and transport and site characterization are releases to the environment, section 2.6, which Mitch covered a little bit. Physical and chemical properties are in section 4. That's a whole section, just really giving you an idea of the chemical structures and how they impact their coefficients. There's a physical and chemical properties external table, table 4.1. If you're looking to understand really the ranges of values for some of these properties that have been reported in the literature, you can go to this table, pull it off. We had amazing people really review the literature and pull out those values. And so they're right there at your fingertips. So please take a look. Section 5 is the meat of the fate and transport processes. Section 6 is a section that goes through all or a good amount of literature values of occurrence in different environmental media. So again, you get to understand the ranges of what's been found in environmental media, whether contaminated sites or ambient sites. You really start to understand that. So that's section 6, and there's additional information in section 17.1. And lastly, we bring it all together for the application in section 10, which is the site characterization section. All right, so you've seen this before. Mitch has talked about this. It's important to consider the source of the release to the environment. This slide summarizes the common sources of PFAS released to the environment that have the potential for significant environmental impact based on the type and magnitude of the release and the types and concentrations of the PFAS associated with that release. So these major sources are areas where these fluorine-containing Class B firefighting foams have been released, whether they're stored and used, there's a spill, or they've been used for a fire event or fire training. And you'll find more about that in sections 2.6.2, and certainly section 3 is all about aqueous film-forming foams. The second one is industrial facilities that produce PFAS or process PFAS, or the facilities that use PFAS products in manufacturing or other activities. And then we get into the landfills and the wastewater treatment plants, which are receivers of PFAS products. So they're not the originators. They don't use it in their businesses, but it comes to them, their recipients, and it'll depend on what they're receiving, what the quality of their effluents are, really what their potential for being a source to the environment is. And certainly any industries that use or produce PFAS compounds are going to have a bigger impact on what these facilities bring in. So that's important to note. Okay, so what is fate and transport? In considering how to approach site characterization, it's important to start with an understanding of how PFAS move and respond in the environment. So of course, you start with the nature of the release, what types of PFAS are released, how much is released, and over what time period it's released. You can have a fire training event that you're looking at one release at one point in time. You can have some industrial air emissions that go over many decades. So that's really something to consider as the nature of release. But really, to consider the fate and transport of it, you have to bring in the characteristics of the PFAS, so the chemical structures that have been introduced by Mitch. And you have to take into consider the site characteristics. So what are the properties of the soil and the properties of the groundwater? Is the atmospheric conditions going to impact that movement? So we'll go through all these a little bit, and we'll review the important aspects of the chemistry, the structure and properties, and with an eye towards applying that to the fate and transport. But certainly there's more details about the physical and chemical properties in section 4 of the guidance document. All right, again, we can't overemphasize the structure. I know, you know, Mitch has said this before, so I just want to kind of bring it home and then maybe get you to think about how this applies to how it's going to move in the environment. So this slide focuses on the perfluoroalkyl acids. These are very persistent in the environment. That carbon backbone with that those fluorines very tightly attached to those carbons is going to be very stable. So once released to the environment, it's going to be pretty much there, and it's going to move through the environment depending on how long that tail is, what type of functional group it has. So this is the perfluoroalkyl acid, and the big takeaway is that they're very persistent in the environment. They also preferentially partition at interfaces. So they have the differential between the properties of the tail being hydrophobic and the head being hydrophilic. And that's how they want to kind of orient themselves in aqueous solution. So you're going to have to take that into consideration. They are going to want to preferentially form at the air-water interfaces. And this is going to be specifically significant for some treatment technologies that need to consider how they move and how they prefer to partition. Seem to be very quick with this. Okay. So what we're looking at here is not PFAAs. These are polyfluoroalkyl substances. Just to give you an idea of how different they can be and really what makes them different, you're going to have a certain type of fluorination, a fluorinated tail, or some level of carbons that have fluorines on them. But you're going to have a different type of functional group or head group, and that head group could have variations on the charges. So we're used to thinking of the perfluoroalkyl acids as being deprotonated and having that negative charge being anionic in the environment, and that helps us understand its solubility and its movement through groundwater and soils. But we also need to consider that there could be cations that are present in the environment, or zwitterions. Zwitterions would have not only a positive charge, but it would have a negative charge. So what you're going to see there is that although they're generally surfactants, and they have their tails stick up into the air phase and orient the head group to the water, this gives important implications for the air-water interfaces, but it also tells you how they might decide to partition as they travel through the soil. They're going to more preferentially partition to the soils. The cations and zwitterions are more likely to be absorbed, and the meaning that the anions will travel further in the groundwater. All right, so the properties of perfluoroalkyl acids. We've gone through this, but repetition is the way you take it home. So negatively charged at typical environmental and physiological pHs, pH of 4 to 10. We're going to find that these negative charges help them to be very water soluble. They're generally surfactants. And generally, at ambient conditions, you're going to find that most of them carry a low vapor pressure and Henry's law coefficient. So it's telling you that there is not a high level of volatility at ambient conditions. And that's PFAAs, okay? And that doesn't consider conditions that aren't ambient conditions. So you are going to, you know, have to consider if they're under higher temperatures or higher pressures, that may change how they're traveling in the environment. So typically the shorter the chain length, the more water soluble the PFAS are and the more mobile they are in the groundwater. And in addition, the shorter chain PFAS are more difficult to remove from water by granulated activated carbon. So hopefully we'll hear more about that in the treatment section. All right. Let me take you through an example of how the chemical structure may impact the behavior of the PFAS molecule in the environment. And for right now, we're talking about PFAAs, the fully fluorinated carbon chains with a negatively charged functional group at the head of the molecule. So what you're looking at here is one set of data that describes the sorption or the organic carbon normalized distribution coefficient, KOC values you see there, of various PFAAs. And this comes from an early paper on this subject. And then we applied similar hypothetical site characteristics to show how that KOC may impact how the retardation may be impacted. So in general, you'll see that the shorter perfluoroalkyl chains, so the four carbons, they're going to travel much faster in the groundwater. They're not going to have that level of retardation. As that chain gets longer, you're going to have a higher level of retardation. So, and you also see a difference between the carboxylates, which you see here in red, and the sulfonate groups, which you see here in blue. For the same number of carbons, the sulfonates are going to have a higher retardation rate than the carboxylates. All right, so things to consider about just kind of really the basic PFAAs. So PFAS may be transported in groundwater at a speed much slower than the speed of water. Okay, so it's going to be retarded behind the speed of water. PFOA is transported slower, but not as slow as PFAS. There's not that amount of retardation or partitioning. So there's some expectation of differential transport after the release of the compounds at the original site. And so although the rate of transport may be limited relative to water, due to the persistence of PFAS, they may create very lengthy plumes, potentially extending for many miles. So we'll get into the transformation of precursors. Mitch introduced this a little bit. So I just talked about PFAAs. And remember that this site, and maybe we haven't really discussed this too much, but most releases of PFAS are typically made up of a mixture of PFAS. So the understanding of the original source and the potential processes acting on the PFAS can be important considering the management of the site. You're not just looking at PFAAs, you're probably looking at a mixture of PFAAs and polyfluorinated compounds. So this is a transformation of a precursor or a polyfluorinated compound to the end product of the perfluoral alkyl acid. In this figure, we see poly and a per, each with a fully fluorinated carbon chain of 8 carbons long. So the perfluorinated compound is stable and won't transform in the environment, whereas the polyfluorinated may be able to be transformed under the appropriate conditions, either biotically or abiotically. And that's a transformation to the perfluorinated compounds, such as PFCAs and PFSAs. And this has been demonstrated in a number of studies. Most precursor transformations occur aerobically or under oxidizing conditions. And we know that fluorotelomeres can only produce perfluorocarboxylates, whereas ECF chemistries can generally produce the perfluorosulfonates. And in some data indicate that carboxylates may be produced too. So importantly, for AFFF, there's been a lot of precursors switched out for PFOA, but historically you'll also find PFHXA and PFHXS in AFFF formulations. Precursors tend to sorb to soils more than PFAAs, which is important to understand for site characterization and modeling plume longevity, as precursors will have the potential to transform over time and can result in a continual leaching of terminal products to the groundwater, representing a continuing ongoing source. All right, let's get into the occurrence in environmental media. So PFAS can be anywhere. It can be in the air, the soil, the groundwater, surface water, sediment, biota. If you want to find out more about typical occurrence concentrations, Section 6 has an excellent discussion of it, really looked at the literature and kind of can give you what we know about existing occurrences of various PFAS in environmental media. The PFAS occurring in this environmental media shown in this slide are subject to these processes, which we're going to roughly go through. And we're going to discuss the sources in the previous section, plus some of the processes that we're going to go through. So let's start with atmospheric transport. This is a tricky one. we say that they're not volatile, but the atmosphere plays a very important role in the distribution of these compounds. If an industry uses or manufactures PFAS and they have any air stack emissions, there's the potential for release of those PFAS through the stack emissions. So although they may not be volatile at typical environmental conditions, the conditions of the stack velocity, the stack temperature, the temperature during the processes, that can really introduce characteristics that increase the potential for emissions through the stack for industrial processes. You can also have atmospheric releases through incineration or fire suppression. There are some PFAS that are inherently volatile, so they would have the ability to be transported in the atmosphere, and they're also subject to transformation. So anything once it's in the atmosphere will kind of be subject to either transformation by processes such as photooxidation, depending on where it's starting out. It's also going to partition. So it's going to partition to aerosols or particulates, and the size of the particulates will help determine how far they're going. So we can have local impacts very close to the release, or we can grow to regional or global scale impacts, depending on the conditions of release and the conditions of the atmospheric transformation. And then once it's transported, what will occur is that it could deposit out of those the atmospheric processes through wet deposition or dry deposition, the wet deposition being any kind of precipitation, and that's going to introduce it into another media. And so we'll get into the transport in the vadose zone. Now, I'm not saying that all the PFAS in the vadose zone is coming from atmospheric emissions, but that is one thing that you need to consider. You know, if you're not finding that direct release on the site, that source, it has the potential for, you know, to be coming from atmospheric emissions and deposition onto the site. So as we move into the vadose zone, the vadose zone is typically aerobic. So these zones can contribute to transformation of PFAA precursors. We also see the process of partitioning in these zones. So migration of PFAS will not only be dependent on the chemical structure of the PFAS, as we've previously discussed, but also on precipitation amount and intensity, the subsequent infiltration, the geochemistry of the soils and precipitation, along with the impacts from the co-contaminants. So many PFAS will absorb to vadose zone soils. And in addition to this useful information about the subsurface hydrogeology and site features, some of the site-specific information needed to understand sorption in the vadose zone includes mineral and organic content, precipitation and infiltration rates, occurrence of co-contaminants, and potentially cation exchange capacity, information on pore size and volume. So there's a really lot to consider. Sorption of long-chain PFAS and strong sorption of cationic or zwitterionic precursors may result in long-term source of PFAAs as precursors transform. And we'll get into the transport in groundwater. All right, once at the groundwater table, transport is expected to be faster, but it's still dependent on chain length and head group. So remember, anything affecting geochemistry can affect their transport. And PFAS releases are complex mixtures, and the composition can change even after PFAS have reached the groundwater due to differential transport. So some of them are going to get to the groundwater faster than the others. You may still find that some of them are in the soils while others are starting to impact the groundwater. So to understand the partitioning behavior of PFAS, you need the same type of information that I just described for understanding the sorption and leaching from the vadose zone, Plus, you need information on groundwater chemistry, so pH, cation concentration, redox. You need information on co-contaminants and the other parameters that affect sorption. If co-contaminants are present and remediation has already occurred to target the other contaminants, you have to consider that that may cause changes in the solution chemistry. And if remediation has driven, say, oxidation on site, that's going to change the precursor transformation or the potential for precursor transformation and increase the PFAA concentrations. So that might kind of give you a disconnect between what you know of as the product that was released and what you're seeing in the environmental media. So this may also facilitate transport by changing pH or other geochemical parameters. So let's take a look at it in another way. So this figure depicts a possible environmental fractionation of PFAS that can occur. In this case, it's at a hypothetical AFFF training area where petroleum is co-located with the PFAS in the source area. So we're starting with source area at the bottom, the fire. That's really going to be the take-home message, is that the complexity of the chemistry and as a result, the fate and transport processes can be a result of many things. So how long ago did the release happen? Has there been time for things to transform to the more stable PFAA? So as you're getting away from the source zone, you're having time for the contaminants to travel, the groundwater to travel. You know, we're kind of considering that over time, it's going to move away from the source zone. So how far away from the potential source? Are you far enough away that no cations have transferred that far? And has there been a significant remediation of other contaminants at the site? In other words, have the remedial processes, for example, oxidation, led to enhanced transformation of the polyfluorinated to PFAAs? So this graphic illustrates some of these points, showing that the plume near the source may be anaerobic, highly concentrated mixture of PFAS and fuel, but as the plume migrates down gradient, it can become less concentrated. And the geochemistry typically shifts from being aerobic and partitioning to some PFAS and biotransformation of others, resulting in relative PFAS ratios across the site. It's also important to note that PFAS, especially the PFAAs, they may migrate faster and further than the other contaminants at your site. Remember, because they're more soluble. And also, in-situ remediation activities aimed at petroleum or other co-contaminants may result in the oxidation of precursors that can create unexpected hotspots. So that's been said, but good to be repeated. All right, so we need to kind of summarize some key takeaways, issues relevant to PFAS. We all know that the science is evolving, and it's evolving fast, and that's why we're here. That's why the ITRC, you know, is here to kind of be on top of the science and be able to bring it to all of you. So we're looking at the state of the science always and how it may impact the management of the contaminated site. And one thing that we really need to investigate is the analytical methodologies. Christy is going to talk a little bit about that. But as these methodologies change, the detection and reporting limits and the expanding parameter lists and the sampling methodologies. So, you know, what is the potential for cross-contamination? What is the reliability of the results? Those are all things that are going to help us understand and be able to rely on the information that we're given to be able to manage the contaminated site. And the regulatory environment really does rely on the state of the science also. And since the state of the science is changing and the regulatory environment continues to want to be protective, there's going to certainly be some movement in changing regulatory limits, sampling procedures, and compounds of interest. So the groundwater is significant. As you know, if you've all managed contaminated sites, the PFAS site characterization tends to focus on drinking water sources, at least initially. I mean, specifically the use of groundwater as a drinking water site. This is because water ingestion is deemed a major route of exposure. So the current regulatory concerns and investigations are geared towards addressing this very important aspect of site management. So you'll need to consider PFAS in the soil, sediment, and surface water also, as they can feed into the groundwater or they have impacts elsewhere. And you have to consider that historical investigations on many sites have missed the potential for PFAS contamination, because until recently, not only they weren't regulated, nobody was really looking for them. You know, we've only really understood the health implications in the last few decades. We have the analytical procedures to detect them in the last few decades. So even though they've been used for many decades, we're really just starting to understand and characterize them. So to understand the historical view of your site is extremely important. And just know that there is a widespread use of these compounds. So there's a potential for multiple releases in a given area. There's a potential for off-site contributions also. So last issues relevant to PFAS, site characterizations concern arise to unique source, fate, and transport properties. So we know that PFAS is unique. It has unique properties according to the chemical structure and that transmits to the fate and transport properties of this class of chemicals. And PFAS can come from atypical sources, which can include contamination from secondary sources. So a secondary source is created from movement of contaminated media into a previously uncontaminated area. One example is the use of biosolids for treatment of soils. So that's typically unimpacted area where the initial contaminated media was brought on. So that's an atypical pathway, atypical sources and atypical pathways. So the air deposition, as I've explained, can become very important, but to understanding potential groundwater impacts. So if we've had air impacts over many decades, it's had that time to deposit to the soils, to migrate through the soils, and then to impact the groundwater. And that's really not typical of a lot of the contaminants that we have become used to dealing with. And there are complex transitions between media. So considering those, the vadose zone, groundwater and surface water interactions, and it might be a little different. Like I said, it might not be so cut and dried. You're looking at different PFAS that have different properties. You're looking at things that are going to occur at different timing. So you're going to have that distribution. And you also want to consider partitioning, as we've discussed. So sorption through the hydrophobic, electrostatic, and interphase partitioning mechanisms. So that is a very high level discussion of the fate and transport. I hope this helped.
All right. Thank you, Sandra and trainers, for delivering those modules here. I'm just going to take back remote control very quickly. And then we're going to jump right into our first Q&A section of the training here. So our first question is, should PFOA be per or polyfluoro? One carbon in PFOA is not bonded to fluorine.
Yep, that's a good question. An astute observation. Nothing's simple with PFAS. That is correct. There is a carbon that's not bonded to fluorine in PFOA. But it is still considered a perfluoro compound because it's not a degradable carbon. It's part of the that carboxyl functional group that's the head of the compound that cannot degrade further. And so it's considered a terminal PFAS product. It's not going to degrade into something smaller and therefore is considered a perfluoroalkyl substance.
All right, thank you, Mitch. All right, next question. Can you explain what a side chain polymer is?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Side chain polymer. It's a tail of sorts that expands off the backbone of the main polymer molecule. The side chain polymer. So it's not mobile in and of itself, but under certain circumstances could break down and become a potentially mobile PFAS compound.
All right, thank you again. Next question. Can they degrade to terminal PFAS?
Okay. Yep. Linking back to that last question. Yes. Yep. Under the right circumstances, yes. Once they break free, they whatever form they break free in can ultimately break down further. They can form terminal PFAS. Yes.
Wonderful, thank you. All right, next question. Are any PFAS compounds considered sufficiently volatile to cause vapor intrusion pathway and exposure to potentially exist?
Yes, that's a good one. They potentially, yes. As with many areas of PFAS, work in progress in terms of understanding how big of an issue it is. But there are some PFAS, particularly some of the short chain PFAS compounds tend to be more volatile. And also some of the precursors, for instance, the FTOH compound that I had shown previously, some of those the neutral PFAS compounds that aren't anions or cations, they can also be volatile. So there is potential for some of these PFAS compounds to be able to volatilize and create a vapor concern. The extent to which that's going to be an issue, again, as mentioned, it's still early in understanding.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mitch. All right, next question. Is there any definitive data regarding the cleaning of AFFF systems, concrete, metal, tanks and pipes, pumps, bladders, etc., for reuse with non-PFAS systems?
Yep, got it. Another area, very active area of research, I would say, in that one in particular. I mean, I guess we're wording the question. Definitive data, in my mind, no, not definitive data, but there's a lot of evolving understanding in terms of where things currently stand. And what we know at this point in time, the triple rinsing doesn't appear to be enough. That some additives are probably needed to adequately remove the PFAS. Ultimately. Understanding of what the actual target levels of removal need to be, that's also an area of uncertainty in terms of what the actual endpoint would be in terms of how clean it needs to be. Also research into the potential for rebound, I guess. Some PFAS may remain hidden in certain areas. So after a certain amount of cleaning, whether there's a potential for PFAS to be to re desorb long after the fact is another area that there's being research being done into.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much, Mitch. Just with to keep us on track here for the rest of our modules today, we are going to jump back into our content. We will have one more Q&A at the end. I know this was a quick one. I just want to make sure that we get all of our content in. So with that, I'm going to pass it off to Christy Herzer again from the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation to talk about PFAS sampling.
Thank you, Devin. All right, jumping into it. Material I'll talk about today, again, can be found in our technical and regulatory guidance document in section 11. Also, I mentioned in the beginning, we have a lot of really amazing external files and tables, and one of those is the analytical methods Excel file. You can find both the basics and specifics of published methods, as well as draft published methods. We also have analyte lists in there for you. So for PFAS sampling events, it is important to have a quality assurance project plan, QAP, or a site-specific work plan, as routine sampling plans don't adequately address PFAS-specific concerns. So these plans should include PFAS-specific standard operating procedures or SOPs, and this will help improve sampling consistency and overall data quality. Federal and state agencies, as well as some consulting firms, do have some guidelines, checklists, and SOPs, and we do have a list of examples in Section 11 of the tech reg. And PFAS sampling is different from other sampling events due to an increased potential for contamination of your sample to occur. And When we talk about contamination, we're talking about the unintentional introduction of PFAS to your sample during either sample collection, shipping, or storage. There are three main reasons for this increased contamination potential. First, the extremely low screening or regulatory criteria results in the concentration that defines contamination to be unusually low. And then second, PFAS can exist at orders of magnitude higher than that regulatory or screening criteria. And because of this, there's an increased risk for your sample to become cross-contaminated because routine decontamination procedures may be inadequate. And then third, some sampling equipment and materials typically used for sampling could contain or may contain PFAS. And so we're mostly focused on those items that do come into direct contact with the sample being collected. We have a list in 11.1.2 of materials to avoid. In addition, you can pretest those items and/or collect equipment rinse blanks. So when planning and preparing for a sampling event, it's important to consider the project objectives, the site history, and your project action levels. Your site history can indicate whether extremely high concentrations of PFAS may be expected in some areas, such as a fire training area. And that information should be considered when determining the frequency of field quality control samples, such as decontamination blanks. Now, your project action levels should be considered when determining the cleanliness requirement or the project's definition of PFAS-free, because sampling equipment, supplies, and field quality control samples will be evaluated against this definition. So, due to all of these issues we just discussed, it's important to develop PFAS project-specific sampling and analysis plans. So, in all sampling and analysis, it requires communication with the lab, starting at the planning stage all the way through data reporting. However, PFAS projects may require additional communication. So, in respect to PFAS, this includes discussion of the verification requirements for sampling supplies, the analyte list, and the definition of PFAS-free for the project, the need for additional sample bottles for quality control, the volume of sample that's required to achieve the laboratory reporting limits, as well as the project sample preparation requirements. So, last slide, I talked about site history. So, if you know that there is a sample that may be relatively high, you should communicate that with your lab if you've got samples that are suspected to contain high concentrations of PFAS. The concentration of PFAS in the sample will dictate the appropriate sample preparation technique to be used. And if you don't communicate this with the lab, then these samples are going to be prepared without that consideration. And it can cause significant cross-contamination issues during sample preparation and can contaminate the analytical instrumentation. And as you might expect, this will cause extensive delays in sample analysis and can potentially affect the data usability. So, to determine if the sampling equipment and materials could contain PFAS, first step is make sure to review any safety data sheets or product specification documents to determine if any sort of PFAS or fluoropolymer content might be indicated. Though, keep in mind that even if it's not listed on the SDS, that doesn't completely assure a material to be PFAS-free. So, in the absence of confident information, perform testing of materials prior to any sampling event to vet the potential for any impacts to your sampling event. A good rule of thumb is when in doubt, check it out. Collect equipment blanks and extra quality control samples and/or have your lab test the materials prior to the sampling event. Another part of the coordination that should be performed with your laboratory is to assure that the entire container used to collect the sample will be used for the extraction and analysis as defined by each of the EPA methods. Therefore, even if a lab requests 500 milliliters of water per sample, if the method, for instance, 537.1 or 533, uses 250 mils for analysis, this necessitates the collection of two 250 milliliter containers. So, some of the supplies needed for your sampling event will be supplied by the laboratory that is performing the analysis. This includes sample containers, solvents used in decontamination processes, as well as water used for blanks in the field and the final rinse of equipment. So, the lab should verify that these materials and supplies are PFAS-free, as defined by your project objectives, prior to shipping them into the field. as well as providing documentation of that verification. For some reason, site water or water other than that lab supplied water is used, don't worry, just take a sample of that and send it to the lab for analysis. So when using reusable equipment in the field, again, close review of the SDS, looking at those soaps and detergents to be used for field decontamination is important. Any soap or detergent that has proprietary fluorosurfactants, best to avoid those. In fact, the recommendation is to use soaps and detergents that have previously been used or tested. And thinking about large equipment, if you don't have access to a decontamination facility, it's likely too expensive and or inconvenient to use PFAS-free water for the entire decontamination process. So use site water for the bulk of the decontamination and then use that PFAS-free water for the final rinse. So ultimately, your QAP created for the site and sampling event should fully describe the field quality controls needed to fulfill and complement the quality control necessary for your project. We do have a list of typical field quality control samples in section 11. A thing to keep in mind is if your sampling event includes a mix of non-potable water methods and drinking water methods, you're going to make sure that the additional requirements for the drinking water methods are met, such as the frequency of field reagent blanks, field duplicates, and the frequency of matrix spikes. If the drinking water analyses are for samples used or considered for compliance, if you omit some of these additional criteria, this could invalidate the sample data that's generated, and you'll likely have to repeat the sampling event. With all of the unknowns associated with PFAS sample collection and the possibility that detection of extremely low levels of some PFAS may trigger regulatory actions, it is critical to have as much quality assurance and quality control data as possible to evaluate the validity of your results. This includes equipment blanks, field blanks, reagent blanks, and ship blanks. So in general, you should not field filter your PFAS water samples to avoid loss of PFAS onto the filter. Some good alternatives are using low flow sampling techniques, and another option is centrifuging in the lab. If filters are used in the lab, they must ensure that those are rinsed with the extraction solvent during processing. So in summary, some special considerations for PFAS sampling. What matters is what comes into contact with the sample and have a practical approach to contamination concerns. Method-specific requirements for sampling, sample preservation, shipping, and holding times vary. There are some general guidelines, but PFAS-specific sampling protocols are recommended. Also, sample event planning and upfront work and communication is critical. So now moving on to analysis. A lot of you have probably heard of EPA methods 537.1 and 533. These are drinking water methods. They have some strong similarities. They both require field reagent blanks. The sample is prepared using solid phase extraction, and both are multi-lab validated methods. However, they do have some differences. They have different chemical preservatives and different collection processes required. For the analysis, they do have different quantification schemes. So I'll get into that in a couple of slides. They also have different holding times and different analyte lists. Speaking of analyte lists, they have 14 PFAS in common to both methods, four unique to 537.1, and 14 are unique to 533. US EPA draft method 1633, the fourth draft just came out in July of 2023, just a couple months ago. This method is applicable to 40 PFAS in groundwater, wastewater, surface water, leachate, biosolids, tissue, sediment, and soil. There are also other published methods, such as OTM 45 and DOD HFFO1. Other test method 45, or OTM 45, is a detailed and complicated sampling and analysis technique that determines PFAS in particulate, adsorbable, and soluble phases. And DOD HFFO1 is applicable to HFFF concentrates for the determination of the concentration of PFOA and PFOS. So there are some key consistencies between all of these methods that I just briefly went over. They all utilize liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry that use analytical standards to identify and quantify individual PFAS. The analyte list for these methods do not include neutral or volatile PFAS, such as the fluorotolamide alcohols. All of the methods, the same equipment and supply concerns associated with field sampling do apply. Now, there are some significant ways in which these methods differ that need to be considered when you're selecting a method. First, the scope of these methods vary greatly. The media that each method has been validated for varies along with the limits of detection and limits of quantitation that are achievable in each media. I know there's a lot on this slide. I'm just going to briefly hit on a couple more points. The method analyte lists also vary. Another significant difference is their sample preparation process and level of sample cleanup steps that are included. But what I really want to hit on is the quantitation scheme utilized by each method. There are three quantitation schemes possible: external standard, internal standard, and isotope dilution quantitation. Depending on the scheme used, the bias associated with the sample preparation, instrumentation, and matrix interference may or may not be accounted for in the quantitation of individual PFAS. So, starting off with external standard quantitation does not account for any of these biases. An example would be EPA method 8327, which I know I didn't hit on. Internal standard quantitation, moving on, this accounts for instrumentation bias, and EPA method 537.1 utilizes internal standard quantitation. Now, isotope dilution, this is the gold standard, and this accounts for sample preparation and instrumentation bias, as well as matrix interference. And EPA method 533 and draft method 1633 use isotope dilution. So, without the proper review and/or validation of the data generated by any of these PFAS methods, the usability of your data can't really be evaluated. EPA does have some published guidance for the review and validation of PFAS water for drinking water collected in accordance with method 537.1. There's also a technical bulletin that has the general principles of PFAS data review. And then DOD has a validation guidance and process for data generated using draft method 1633. We do have a summary of key points from these data validation documents as an external table on the ITRC website. And in recent years, a number of non-targeted analysis techniques have been developed and employed predominantly by research laboratories, but with the recent increase in evaluating precursors and total fluorine, a number of commercial laboratories do now offer total oxidizable precursor assay as well as extractable or adsorbable organic fluorine. I should note that these techniques lack published multi-laboratory validated methods, and they're primarily qualitative in nature, so the results require a fair amount of interpretation. So some takeaway points are, there are multiple PFAS analytical methods published and or under development. There are significant differences between these methods, and these differences need to be understood and evaluated to ensure they're useful and enable the project's data quality objectives to be met. And there are also lesser standardized techniques available, can be used as qualitative or screening tools. These can be helpful, especially when thinking about total PFAS load on treatment adsorbents such as granular activated carbon. And just with any of the modules that you're hearing about today, the information presented is just a brief overview, and we encourage you to check out our website to get more in-depth for any of your PFAS needs. And with that, I will pass it on.
Excellent. Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry, let me just see if I can take control of the slides here. There we go. My name is Andy Tofolco. I'm an environmental engineer at Brown and Caldwell, and I co-lead the ITRC PFAS treatment subgroup with my colleague Cliff Shirk with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for hanging with us. It's a lot to take in. Treatment technologies will be the final section of today's training before we wrap up with our final Q&A. The most up-to-date tech reg document is hosted on the ITRC's PFAS team webpage, which we've been discussing. Treatment technologies are covered in Section 12, and as part of Section 12, there's a supporting treatment technology summary table that you can download. as well as a handful of associated case studies that are highlighted in section 15.2. The ITRC treatment technology writing subgroup has defined three primary categories for evaluating treatment technologies. First, we have field implemented technologies, which are those that have been demonstrated at multiple locations by multiple practitioners and are well documented in practice or the peer-reviewed literature. Second, we have limited application technologies, which may have been field implemented, but only at a limited number of sites or by a limited number of practitioners and are generally not as well documented. And finally, we have developing technologies, which are those that have only been demonstrated at the lab or the bench scale, typically by a limited number of research groups and are not as widely vetted. Over time, we anticipate that technologies may advance from the developing stage to the limited application stage, and ultimately from the limited application stage to the field demonstrated stage. So the technological classification can change as a reflection of advances in these individual technologies development. And in fact, during the most recent update to the guidance document, some technologies graduated from limited application to field implemented, and I will make note of those as we discuss them. In the tech reg document I mentioned, there is a summary table, and it's really a reference and a screening tool that includes PFAS treatment technology spanning the technology development spectrum. The pending updates to the tech reg include the table shown here, which is a shift from the previous version. Previously, there were two separate tables, one for liquids treatment and one for solids treatment. The updated table has been consolidated and reformatted for increased user functionality. The technologies are tabulated according to the technology's treatment mechanism, technology maturity, applicability to different environmental media, and includes references to the applicable sections and associated case studies within the main body of the tech reg document. In the treatment summary table, ITRC is trying to capture the technologies that have been documented, or there's meaningful published literature on these various technologies, but not all of them are discussed at length in the main body of the tech reg. The summary table here for chapter 12 is really a screening tool that helps you identify specific technologies. Again, that might span the spectrum of development. Okay, so now we'll get into the discussion of individual field implemented technologies, starting with technologies to address PFAS impacted liquids. Currently, application of effective liquid treatment technologies are all separation based technologies. In other words, they separate and concentrate the PFAS from the bulk phase into a solid phase or sometimes a lower volume liquid fraction. Many of the destructive technologies for PFAS impacted liquids remain in the limited or developing categories. The section numbers you see here refer to where information on each of these topics can be found within the web-based technical and regulatory guidance document. When it comes to selecting treatment alternatives, the overall treatment objectives are critically important and can drive much of the direction that you might choose to go. But as we've highlighted throughout this training, that in the world of PFAS, things are changing rapidly, and treatment objectives are compound specific and can vary between country or region that you're operating in. So something to keep in mind. So getting into it, adsorption technologies using granular activated carbon, or sometimes called GAC, and ion exchange media are the most commonly implemented technologies for PFAS removal in liquids because of their demonstrated effectiveness. GAC does have a longer deployment history, but ion exchange installations are catching up. The design of these systems typically involves what we call a lead lag vessel configuration, which allows for the operational resiliency to continuously meet the low treatment targets associated with PFAS. More often than not, pretreatment of the water matrix is a key consideration, depending on what kind of water specifically that you're designating for treatment. Both GAC and ion exchange technologies do generate waste streams, and that's important to consider, most prominently as spent media when the media become exhausted. The options and cost for waste management should be considered in the overall life cycle cost because they may be significant. And additionally, I'll note that impending hazardous substance designation by the US EPA will have an impact on waste disposal options for spent media. So specifically looking at activated carbon, it's got a long tenure of application for PFAS treatment. And beyond that, it has a long history of application in the water treatment industry in general to address numerous contaminants of concern. And as a result, we know a lot about GAC and how to operate GAC systems. So if necessary, GAC can be deployed quickly, particularly in addressing emergency situations. GAC can be derived from a variety of raw materials, and often we call these feedstocks. Three common GAC feedstocks include bituminous coal, subbituminous coal, and coconut shell or coconut husk. To date, GAC derived from bituminous coal feedstocks has often exhibited better performance with regards to PFAS removal efficiency. Some GAC-specific design and operating considerations. The industry is standard around an empty bed contact time between 10 and 15 minutes for each GAC vessel if you're running a lead lag configuration. In general, a couple of notes. The carboxylate compounds will break through faster than their sulfonate counterparts. And we will also see a similar trend in short chain versus long chain compounds where the short chains will break through first relative to the long chain compounds. Site-specific water quality will dictate the pretreatment needs. Elevated concentrations of certain parameters can pose fouling concerns or can promote biological growth, which will ultimately lead to diminished performance. So if the additionally, if you're not pre-filtering upstream of the GAC vessels, you'll likely require operational backwashes between changeouts, which will also generate residual media requiring proper management. As with any adsorbent media, it's important to properly condition GAC media prior to use, and the manufacturers will provide guidance on how to properly accomplish that. So moving on to anion exchange resins, as a field implemented technology similar to GAC, ion exchange is a very scalable technology that can be used for very small or very large flows. Ion exchange does require pretreatment and has similar media conditioning requirements that I just mentioned relative to GAC during startup and commissioning. Some differences that I'd like to highlight between GAC and ion exchange is that the ion exchange has a significantly shorter contact time relative to GAC, typically between 2 and 4 minutes, which relates to a much smaller footprint from an overall a kind of size of treatment system required based on that shorter contact time. Additionally, ion exchange is more PFAS selective than GAC, and as a result has a higher absorption capacity for PFAS on a per unit mass basis. With that in mind, ion exchange is typically more expensive compared to GAC, and the selection between GAC and ion exchange at a site is often driven by site-specific factors. So I will highlight that site-specific testing is highly encouraged to inform this selection process. One thing to be aware of regarding ion exchange is the emergence of regenerable ion exchange resins. The operation configuration is very similar with regards to the need for, pretreatment, pre-filtration, lead lag kind of configuration. But there will be additional on-site infrastructure associated with the regeneration process. And during the regeneration process, you will end up with a concentrated brine residual that will typically contain high concentrations of PFAS that will require separate disposal and management. Moving on to high pressure membranes as a field implemented technology for PFAS impacted liquids. High pressure membranes do have a long history of application in the drinking water, wastewater, and water reuse space. These applications target removal of large swaths of both inorganic and organic constituents to the extent that applications of certain reverse osmosis systems may require the treated water to be remineralized to reduce its corrosivity. high pressure membranes serve as a physical barrier in the PFAS treatment application space, providing that additional level of assurance that PFAS spanning a large range of physical and chemical properties are being removed. However, the downside is that the recovery of these systems is limited by the seed water quality and typically results in concentrated reject water residuals that represent between 10 and 25% of the influent volume. Managing the rejected water residuals are a major concern when considering the application of high pressure membrane systems. Identifying nanofiltration membranes that are more resistant to fouling while maintaining high PFAS selectivity is an active area of research to increase system recovery and reduce the residuals management volumes associated with high pressure membrane systems. So foam fractionation is an example of a liquids treatment technology that graduated from the limited application category to the field implemented category during this last update to the tech reg document. As was discussed in the fate and transport section of this training, many PFAS concentrate at the air-water interfaces, and high concentrations have been observed in PFAS foams that form on contaminated water bodies. So foam fractionation leverages and takes advantage of this behavior and uses small air bubbles or sometimes even ozone. You might hear that process referred to as ozone fractionation to generate a foam that is then collapsed and further concentrated. Foam fractionation has been applied at full scale for PFAS at a handful of sites, mostly overseas, Australia, Tasmania, and Europe. However, US-based applications are coming online. Essentially, air or ozone is again bubbled through columns to carry the PFAS and collected in a foam at the top of the column, where that foam is spilled over and then subsequently collapsed and then sent to further fractionator columns to continue to concentrate that PFAS-laden residual. The resulting foam concentrate represents a smaller, much smaller volume of material, which does require eventual treatment or off-site management or disposal. In some cases, ion exchange media or activated carbon or even an RO unit may be used to polish the treated effluent to get to those non-detect levels, particularly for short chain compounds, which are less susceptible to fractionation. So moving into colloidal activated carbon as another example of a field implemented technology that graduated from the limited application category. The core mechanisms underpinning colloidal activated carbon treatment are very similar to the ex situ GAC analog. However, colloidal activated carbon is unique in its delivery and particle size. The colloidal activated carbon is injected into the subsurface to mitigate vertical and horizontal migration of dissolved phase PFAS impacts. And in this way, is the only in situ approach in this section for PFAS impacted liquids. The colloidal activated carbon particles are typically around 2 microns in diameter, which promotes their distribution in the subsurface, in addition to increased adsorption kinetics and enhanced per mass adsorbing capacity based on this increase in surface area. The longevity of PFAS adsorption in situ is dependent on many factors and is an active area of research. Existing models indicate that PFAS are demobilized on the order of decades, and site-specific testing can support the development of long-term performance estimates. So it's often necessary to combine treatment technologies into integrated remediation solutions to achieve project objectives, and that's really the highlight of this slide. While integrated technologies can be needed to address multiple media, this slide focuses on specifically the water and water treatment process. The water matrix may contain constituents at levels that may require pretreatment because they could interfere or significantly reduce the effectiveness of the targeted PFAS treatment technology. So integrated solutions can include combinations of different treatment mechanisms, including separation, adsorption, or even destruction to achieve the targeted endpoints. Many factors play into the selection and identification of these integrated treatment solutions. And some key drivers are the treatment objectives, of course, whether or not you need primary and polishing technologies, whether or not you're managing liquid and solid waste, the management of waste and understanding the magnitude of waste generation during the PFAS treatment lifecycle are critical factors in the selection of PFAS treatment, integrated PFAS treatment solutions. So that culminated our discussion on field implemented liquids treatment technologies, and we'll be moving on to field implemented solids treatment technologies. For solids such as soils, sediments, and sludge, there are a handful of fields demonstrated technologies such as excavation and disposal, activated carbon-based soil stabilization, and soil washing. Alternative soil stabilization, sorption, and solidification, and in-situ or ex-situ thermal treatments are considered developing treatment technologies for soils and are further discussed in the web-based tech reg. So classic dig and haul, a long-standing remedial approach for soils, can be used to manage PFAS impacted soils. When landfilling, check with the landfill prior to moving to that stage, because not all disposal locations will accept PFAS impacted material. And again, I mentioned previously that pending EPA regulations or designation as a CERCLA hazardous substance is likely to impact which facilities will accept PFAS impacted material. Excavation followed by offsite incineration is also an option. The US EPA and DOD, amongst others, are closely investigating the ultimate fate and transport of PFAS impacted materials under various incineration conditions. While under the most extreme incineration scenarios, destruction is assumed. However, it has not been extremely well documented. There's also soil stabilization as a field implemented technology. There's a mixture of proprietary and specialized products and chemicals out there, but essentially we're working with a soil amendment to demobilize the PFAS in the soil matrix. And how that works is using a cocktail of different materials that include adsorbents, that include other mechanical fixing additives that need to be well mixed into the matrix, and then allowed to react, ultimately again significantly reducing the mobility of PFAS within the soil matrix. And similar to the in situ colloidal activated carbon approach, we do see questions regarding the longevity of these approaches in demobilizing PFAS. So finally, moving on to soil washing as a field implemented technology. Soil washing really hinges on the separation of the fine soil fraction from the coarse soil fraction. And PFAS are believed to be or are observed to be primarily sorbed to the fine soil fraction. And so where we can achieve a significant separation between the coarse and the fine soil fractions, we can significantly reduce the volume of impacted material. Certain studies have demonstrated mass reductions of soil in excess of 99.4%. If you end up with a large amount of fines that require disposal, this is likely not cost effective. And as part of the soil washing process, you generate a liquid side stream that does require treatment. Full-scale soil washing plants built in southern Australia at the Australian Defense Soil Stockpile Treatment. There is also a full-scale facility in Canada and pilot-scale operations in the U.S. Lastly, incineration is a mature technology that has been used for various solid and liquid waste, but its impacts on PFAS treatment are less known and remain a topic of study. Questions remain regarding the ultimate fate and transport of PFAS through the incineration process and the potential to generate air emissions. These are something that are being looked at and studied to understand the potential to generate impacts or how to best control PFAS emissions during the incineration process. So that is it for my section, and that wraps up today's training. So I will turn it back over to our host.
All right, thank you, Andy. I'm just gonna real quick get that remote control back to you. So with that, we're running a bit over time, so I'm gonna jump right into our last Q&A section. It's gonna be a little bit quick so that we can still wrap up our training today, and I just like to say I appreciate the attendees sticking with us. So the first question, is there a moratorium on incineration with PFAS?
Yeah. The DOD up until July of this year, July of 2023, did have a formal temporary moratorium on the incineration of PFAS waste. However, in July of 2023, that was lifted. However, they did caveat that additional study is being conducted to, again, better understand the fate and transport of PFAS through the incineration process. But however, that moratorium has been lifted.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Andy. All right, next question. What is the recommended frequency for the collection of field blanks?
Yeah, sure, I can take that, Devin. So for finished drinking water, the frequency would be one field reagent blank for every sample set at every site. But be sure to check out the published methods for specifics.
All right, thank you, Christy. So I know that was short and sweet. And we did, our trainers were putting responses to some of those questions in the Q&A pod. I would just like to take a moment to thank all of our attendees for joining us today, and another moment to thank our expert trainers for not only volunteering to make this possible, but also being here today and providing those wonderful modules and all the support that it took to get this done behind scenes. I would just like to offer that we do provide certificates of completion for our training webinars. They are available by completing the feedback form, which is available through the Cluin training page that brought you here today. So the way that you enter the webinar, that has the information for you, whether it's the webinar slides, the guidance document, or the feedback form, it's all on that page. And feel free to email us if you have any further questions or if we were unable to get to your question at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we'll make sure to coordinate with our trainers to get those questions answered. So with that, I will just wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and thank you again for joining us.